Let's talk sports. This is Kent Batty, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading to you today from the USA Today Sports Weekly for the week October 22nd through the 28th. And since it's that time of year, we're going to start with baseball. The Los Angeles Dodgers circled around one another Friday night, the 17th, spraying champagne and guzzling beer, with a few taking turns sliding on the wet tarp. But no matter how deep into the night the celebration lasted, no matter how many adult beverages were consumed, they still couldn't adequately describe what they'd just witnessed. They knew they were part of history. They knew they had never seen anything like it. There was nothing like it in the history books. It just didn't seem humanly possible. So how could they express what Shohei Ohtani just did in front of a frenzied sellout crowd of 52,883 that screamed and cheered so loud that Dodger Stadium actually shook? What we witnessed, Dodgers third baseman Max Muncy said, was the single greatest game by a baseball player in the history of baseball. Outfielder Teoscar Hernandez said, "It was the greatest game by a human. This is a performance that I've just never seen," Dodgers manager Dave Roberts said. "No one's ever seen something like this. There's a reason why he's the greatest player on the planet." There wasn't a hint of hyperbole by anyone in their clubhouse to describe Ohtani's performance. The reality is that Ohtani became the first player in history to hit 3 home runs, strike out 10 batters, and pitch 6 shutout innings. Sometimes you've got to check yourself and touch him to make sure he's just not made of steel, Dodgers first baseman Freddie Freeman said. Absolutely incredible. Biggest stage, and he goes out and does something like that. It'll probably be remembered as the Shohei Ohtani game. Ohtani's night was so impressive that he actually hit more home runs than the 2 hits he allowed. He struck out more batters than the combined total of the Milwaukee Brewers' entire starting rotation of this series. He was the 12th player to hit 3 home runs in a postseason game and joined Hall of Famer George Brett as the only players to do it from the leadoff spot. The greatest playoff performance in baseball ever? I think there's no question about it, said Andrew Friedman, Dodgers president of baseball operations. Through 4 innings, I texted our Slack thread and said, "This is the greatest 4 innings ever played in postseason history by a major leaguer. The greatest 4 innings ever." Then he hits another home run. "The greatest 6 innings ever. 7 innings. Well, there's no question about it. It was the greatest performance in the postseason in the game ever." The only real debate of the night was just how far Ohtani's second home run traveled in the 4th inning, clearing the right field pavilion and landing in the picnic area. "That one kind of took everybody's breath away," said shortstop Mookie Betts. "It was measured at 469 feet. "That's the farthest ball I've ever seen hit," Muncy said. "I've played a lot of games here, and I've never seen a ball go that far. I know StatCast said 460, but I don't care what StatCast says. StatCast is wrong. I know this stadium really well. I know the dimensions. I know how deep the bleachers are. That ball was not less than 500 feet, maybe even further. There's only one person who can do that in the world and in the history of this game," Dodgers utility man Enrique Hernandez said, "and it's him. It really doesn't matter. When this performance is retold generations from now, it will be a 600-foot homer, maybe 700 feet. We were sitting in the bullpen watching that fly out of here, and we lost it," Dodgers reliever Anthony Bunda said. "We thought it had left the stadium. It went over the clearing of the pavilion roof. We never even saw it land. It was incredible." Ohtani gave up just 1 hit through 6 innings when he tired in the 7th. He walked the leadoff batter, gave up a single, and was taken out of the game only as a pitcher, walking off the mound to a roar that could be heard to Malibu. Well, like any good entertainer, he decided to return to the stage for an encore. He hit Brewers closer Trevor McGill's 98.9-mile-per-hour fastball over the center field fence 427 feet away leaving the crowd and his own teammates screaming in awe. "I was in my office having to do something," Dodgers president Stan Kasten said, "and I said something completely unprintable. So there," said Muncy. "It's kind of funny. There wasn't one person in the dugout that didn't think he was going to hit a home run tonight. He hits the second one, and we're all talking. Is this the single greatest game anyone's ever played? Everyone at the same time just said, you know he's going to hit another." The only other time a pitcher hit three home runs in a baseball game was Jim Tobin of the Boston Braves in 1932, and that was a regular season game. Now it's off to the World Series, where the Dodgers will face the Toronto Blue Jays with a chance to become the first National League team to win back-to-back World Series in 49 years. "Before this season, they were saying the Dodgers are ruining baseball," Roberts said on stage while raising the National League Championship trophy. "Let's get four more wins and really ruin baseball." Well, that narrative can wait. This night all belonged to Ohtani. Betts, standing in the clubhouse, still shaking his head in disbelief, said there are no words to describe Ohtani, but he sure knows what it feels like to be his teammate. "We're like the Chicago Bulls, and he's Michael Jordan. I can tell my kids one day that I got to play with Ohtani. There's just no more words that you can say about what he does. It's just Shohei being Shohei. A once-in-a-lifetime talent who put on a show for the ages Friday, perhaps paving the way for future generations. He gets put in these situations where you expect the incredible," Dodgers pitching coach Mark Pryor says, "and very rarely does he disappoint. To be able to impact the game on both sides of the game is unbelievable. I think he is trying to inspire a different generation that it can be done. It's not easy by any means, but it's pretty cool for him to pave the way." What a night. What a performance. Now, because of the publishing deadlines that the newspaper I'm reading faces, they don't have a story about Toronto's victory over the Seattle Mariners in their Game 7, so I picked one off of Sportsnet to fill in that side of the ledger. They are the $500 million man and the injured pending free agent shortstop waiting his payday. They are prized free agent signings, a 41-year-old future Hall of Famer and a 22-year-old wunderkind who flew up five levels to shine in the playoffs. They are trade acquisitions, minor league free agents, draft picks, and international signings serendipitously discovered while scouting a different player, that's player, and a waiver claim. Together, they turned the Toronto Blue Jays around after an 88-loss 2024 season to win the American League East, beat the New York Yankees in the ALDS, and push a riveting ALCS against the Mariners to seven games. And then, just when it looked like they'd enjoyed the last of their comebacks in a season full of them, George Springer, still hobbled by the fastball taken off his right kneecap in Game 5, conjured up yet another moment of October magic, sending an Eduardo Basardo sinker 381 feet to left field for a three-run homer, as a crowd of 44,770 made Rogers Center shake. The seventh inning, the latest entrant into the franchise's pantheon of greatest swings, alongside those of Joe Carter, Ed Sprague, Roberto Alomar, Jose Bautista, and Edwin Encarnacion, sent the Blue Jays to a nervy 4-3 win that secured their first trip to the World Series since the second of back-to-back championships in 1993. Game 1 against the defending champion LA Dodgers, featuring the great Shohei Ohtani, Mookie Betts, Freddie Freeman, and old friend Teoscar Hernandez, and so many others, is Friday in Toronto at 8 p.m. Eastern. And Springer signed back in January of 21 to a $150 million six-year contract to help create a new set of enduring moments for the club, did just that to make it happen. "I love this team so much," Springer, American League champion hat on backwards, tarp off, drenched in champagne and beer, said amid the celebratory post-game mayhem. "I had a headache from screaming. I remember how loud the stadium was. I've watched the Bautista moment over and over again. It felt like it was that loud. I wasn't there for that. Just an incredible moment." Incredible only begins to describe it, as the Blue Jays rallied from deficits of 2-0 and 3-2 in the best of seven series, and then from 3-1 down through 6.5 innings to slay their various organizational demons, while sending the Mariners, who were eight outs away from their first ever World Series, to yet another playoff trauma. Authors of 49 comeback wins during the regular season, plus two more in the playoffs heading into Monday's Game 7, only the second in franchise history, the Blue Jays, as they so often have had the bottom of the lineup, get things started on an Addison Barger walk, on an Isaiah Kiner-Falefa single, and an Andrés Giménez sacrifice before Springer came up. With the base open, the Mariners opted to pitch to Springer, who had continued to grind even though he really looked like someone trying to hit on a right knee that had been struck by a 95.6-mile-per-hour fastball only 3 days earlier. He took a sinker in from Bizardo for ball one before the right-hander doubled up on the pitch, had it run back over the heart of the plate, and watched Springer send it to Mariners' agony and Blue Jays' ecstasy. "That's the coolest moment of my career," said Kiner-Falefa. "I've watched him do it in the postseason multiple times on TV, but to be on base when he did that, incredible. I've never heard a stadium erupt like that. George showed up for the team when we needed him most. The reason he's in Toronto is to carry us to the World Series, and he did that," said Nathan Lukes, who was watching from the on-deck circle. "That's the best thing I've seen in person on a baseball field. I was ready for the at-bat, but he deserved it. Everything that he's gone through over these past 2 years, it was always him. This entire year, it was always him. He put us in the World Series," said Dalton Varsho, whose RBI single in the first cashed in a Springer leadoff walk to tie the game at 1-1. "That's what he does. It's ridiculously hard. You got a pitch he could drive, and he didn't miss it," said Bo Bichette, who is making progress from his right knee sprain and vowed to be ready for the series. "I had no doubt in my mind. His ability to slow it down, you know, things can speed up on you when the crowd gets like that. I wasn't surprised at all, and I had no doubt." In the Blue Jays dugout, manager John Schneider followed a season-long superstition by sitting beside hitting coach David Popkins when the team was in need of runs. They were thinking through what they would do if the Mariners walked Springer and brought in lefty Gabe Spier to face Lukes. Instead, they watched Springer send them to their latest and greatest comeback this year yet. "Pop said it's really good that we've got a lot of practice at this. This is the moment we've been working on all season," said Schneider. "Never count us out. I've said to you guys, it's almost unbelievable at times, but right now it's pretty believable," said Popkins. "Every single one of those comebacks builds confidence in being behind. It's easy to be ahead a lot and cruise, but to feel that pressing desire to score and the urgency is hard. Luckily, we had a lot of reps throughout the year." Also, with a lot of reps, not only this year but throughout his career, is Springer. Some Blue Jays saw a poetic justice in the moment finding him, after Mariners fans cheered when he was hit in Game 5 and booed as he limped to first base before coming out. "As soon as they didn't walk him, to me they were blank. Karma always collects," said Popkins. "They were cheering when he was hurt. This game remembers everything. I knew it was his time." The home run was Springer's fourth of the 25 postseason and the 23rd of his career in the playoffs, tying Carl Schwarber for third most ever behind Manny Ramirez's 29 and Jose Altuve's 27. This one became instant lore, too, destined to be a staple of broadcast highlights, packs, and social media algorithms. Springer has done it so often and with such ease that it belies how difficult succeeding in such pressure cooker moments actually is. "For a normal person, it's extremely hard," said Popkins. "Extremely hard because you have to control the physiological effects on your body and on your mind, your heartbeat, when you have all that noise. They're hard, they're stressful, but he knows how to zoom all that stuff out and lock in. He's the best in the world at it. A lot of it is innate. A lot of it comes from experience. That's all him," he continued. He's very blessed to be able to handle those moments. He was built for this game, built for those moments, built to play at the highest of levels. Added ace Kevin Gausman, who pitched a scoreless seventh during an all-hands-on-deck day. That's what he's been, the big moment. He just raises his game. To see him come through with that knee, he doesn't feel great right now, but in that moment, he was huge. Also huge was the way Blue Jays locked down the leads Springer's swing provided. Chris Bassett ripped through Randy Arozarena, Eugenio Suarez, and J.P. Crawford in a brilliant and necessary lockdown eighth. Jeff Hoffman, fresh off two innings and 35 pitches to close out Sunday's 6-2 win, then struck out Leo Rivas, pinch hitter Dominic Canzone, and Julio Rodriguez, whose solo shot in the third off Shane Bieber had given Seattle a 2-1 lead in a powerhouse ninth, getting mobbed on the mound as the dome went berserk. The victory, like so many others during this most remarkable of Blue Jays seasons, was a product of the collective. Vladimir Guerrero, a force throughout seven games, batting 10 for 26 with three doubles, three home runs, three RBIs, and four walks, was a deserving pick as ALCS MVP. But none of the Blue Jays' success this season could have happened without Springer, who, at 36 years old, rebounded from a dismal 220, 303, 371 season last year to bat 309, 399, 560, with 32 homers and 84 RBIs in one of the best seasons of his career. And while all was on the verge of coming to an end, he made sure his team was one of the final two standing. This is just the cherry on top, and hopefully there's a bigger cherry on top in the World Series. But there are a lot of people that wrote George Springer off, said Bassett. And for him to work as hard as he's worked, to have the season he's had, and then to have a moment in the playoffs that's historic, I could not be more proud or happier for George. He handled himself like an absolute pro, and for him to have that moment was really special. And now, another World Series, the third for Springer and the third for the Blue Jays, a group that time and again has become a greater whole than the sum of its parts, awaits. Okay, time for a look at pro football with the 32 things we learned this week. This is by Nate Davis, who's with USA Today. 0. Still the number of wins for the New York Jets, who dropped to 0-7 after another pathetic offensive performance against the Panthers. And we have another 0. Apparently, also the number of quarterback ones the New York Jets now have after Justin Fields was yanked for Tyrod Taylor on Sunday. Coach Aaron Glenn hasn't committed to a starter for Week 8. 1. Could the Kansas City Chiefs and the Philadelphia Eagles become the first teams in NFL history to cross paths in the Super Bowl three times in a four-year span? Yes. The answer is yes. That is most definitely within the realm of possibility as of October 19th, 25. But Sunday afternoon suggests the likelihood is suddenly much better with both teams, who met in Super Bowls 57 and 59, seemingly curing some of their recent ills amid encouraging victories. 2. Coming off a massive fail at the end of its three-peat quest in February, KC very much seems to be recapturing its dynastic form, winning for the fourth time in the past 5 weeks after whitewashing Las Vegas Raiders 31-0. Patrick Mahomes was back in MVP form, pulled for the fourth quarter after passing for 286 yards and three TDs. 2 to wide receiver Rashee Rice, playing in his first game in more than a year after having knee surgery 12 months ago before serving a 6-game suspension to start the season. 3. Meanwhile, think Eagles quarterback Jalen Hurts can't throw effectively? He compiled a perfect passer rating, 158.3 in the NFL, in a 28-22 defeat of the Minnesota Vikings. All three of his TDs and nearly every one of his 326 yards divided between the wide receivers A.J. Brown, who went for 121 yards and two TDs, and Devontae Smith, who had 183 yards with a single TD. And, y'all, he did this against the Vikings, one of the nastiest, most pressurized defenses in the league. 4. Nitpick the perennial elite powers of the roaring 2020s all you want. Just realize you may once again be doing it all the way to Super Bowl 60 next February in Santa Clara, California. 4A. If you were historically curious, the Pittsburgh Steelers and Dallas Cowboys are currently the only teams to meet on Super Sunday three times, though that occurred over the course of 21 seasons, 75, 78, and 95. 5. The number of touchdown passes thrown Sunday in London by LA Rams quarterback Matthew Stafford, a single game record for an international series game. The barrage matched Stafford's career best. He'd done it four other times. But the first time he's fired five for the Rams, his most recent occurrence a decade ago with the Lions. 5A. The number of players who have played in multiple international games in the same season, but for different teams. Recently acquired Jacksonville Jaguars cornerback Greg Newsom II joined the list Sunday, 2 weeks after he played in London for the Cleveland Browns. 6. If Stafford hadn't previously joined the unofficial race to be the league's 25 MVP, he's most certainly in a field with Mahomes, Tampa Bay Buccaneers quarterback Baker Mayfield, the Dallas Cowboys' Dak Prescott, and others now. 7. I don't know what a CU celebration is, question mark. For those of you, I mean us, who don't really give a rip about European soccer, it's what Portuguese star Ronaldo does after scoring a goal on a pitch, in a match, maybe a friendly, perhaps off a set piece, whatever. The Rams gave him a few nods on Sunday. 8. Speaking of soccer, seems there's some synergistic growth between the Rams and London-based Arsenal of the Premier League. Both are owned by Stan Kroenke, Rams coach Sean McVay, and Arsenal manager Mikel Arteta also have a blooming mutual admiration club. 9. The number of consecutive regular season games in which Rams outside linebacker Byron Young has recorded at least a half a sack. No word as to whether any of the quarterbacks he bagged took a dive in a bid to draw a yellow card. Wrong bullet point, sorry. 10. One more shout out to the Rams and their social media team, who wrapped up about a day and a half's worth of work in the UK with a nod to the Beatles and their Abbey Road album cover. 11. The number of consecutive games during which the Browns had scored 17 points or fewer. That ended Sunday when they dunked the drowning Miami Dolphins 31-6. 12. Cleveland quarterback Dillon Gabriel isn't posting crazy numbers, but he's certainly taking care of the ball. Fellow rookie Quinshon Judkins did the heavy lifting Sunday with a season-best 3 TD runs, the first time he'd scored multiple times in an NFL game. 13. The number of penalties, for a total of 119 yards, incurred by the Jaguars in Sunday's London loss. 14. The number of sacks Jacksonville quarterback Trevor Lawrence has absorbed in the past two games, 7 apiece. Prior to that, he'd never been sacked more than 5 times in a single contest during his entire career of 5 years. 15. Jaguars rookie wide receiver and cornerback Travis Hunter posted his best stat line of the season, 8 catches, 101 yards, a touchdown, and pass defensed. But the impact still is not there. Hunter's first NFL score, a 34-yarder, doing little more than averting a Rams shutout. 16. And this is why the Green Bay Packers traded for defensive end Micah Parsons, who racked up a career-best 3 sacks in Sunday's narrow 27-23 escape from the Arizona Cardinals. His 29 pressures paced the lead. 16A, hope the flight home was nice, fellas. Congrats to the Panthers, winners of 3 in a row for the first time in 4 years. But quarterback Bryce Young apparently will not be healthy enough to go for 4 in a row after suffering a high ankle sprain. 18. Quarterback Jaden Daniels' hamstring injury, depending on its severity, could cast a serious pall over the prospects of the Washington Commanders, who've lost 3 of 4 and nearly dropped into the NFC East basement. Fortunately for the Commanders, the Denver Broncos bowed up on the weekend when they honored their Super Bowl 50 champions and put the late, great wide receiver Demaryius Thomas into their Ring of Fame. More on Denver later. 19. With a 61-yard field goal Sunday, Cowboys kicker Brandon Aubrey has now hit from 60-plus 5 times in his 3-year career, already an NFL record. 20. Prescott didn't set a record Sunday, but he continues to play exceptionally well for a team that relies heavily on him, becoming the third player in NFL history to throw at least 3 touchdown passes and compile a passer rating of at least 120.0 in 4 straight games. 21. San Francisco 49ers running back Christian McCaffrey may not be the so-called best player in the league, but he led his decimated team to another win Sunday night against Atlanta, outgaining those Falcons' counterpart Bijan Robinson by 109 yards in a victory. Bijan Robinson, of course, played here in Tucson for South Point Catholic High School. Number 22, Drake May and the first-place New England Patriots are quickly making their fans forget about Tom Brady. Just checking that those of you who have already read this so far are still paying close attention. But May did eclipse one of TB12's team records Sunday, connecting on 21 of 23 passes for a 91.3% completion rate, best in team history. 23. May is also part of a Patriots squad that's won 3 road games in 3 weeks, another franchise first. We'd already learned this year that former New England coach Bill Belichick and his 8 Super Bowl rings are overrated, but Brady was wicked average too, apparently. 24. A 31-13 rout of the aimless Titans had to feel good to current Pats coach Mike Vrabel, who was dismissed by Tennessee after the 23 season for philosophical reasons, despite the success he'd had in Nashville. 25. New England has 5 wins this season. 25A. Tennessee has 4 wins since Vrabel left. 26. Kudos to another former exiled head coach, current Chicago Bears defensive coordinator Dennis Allen. His current charges embarrassed the New Orleans Saints, who fired Allen midway through the 24 campaign. The Bears racked up at least 3 takeaways for the 4th straight game while sacking Saints quarterback Spencer Rattler 4 times. 27. And just maybe the monsters of the Midway are back. Under rookie coach Ben Johnson, who has led the Bears to their first 4-game winning streak in 7 years. 28. Per Optostats, the number of venues Rams wide receiver Devontae Adams has scored a touchdown in after finding the end zone 3 times Sunday at London's Wembley Stadium. Only Hall of Famers Jerry Rice at 33 and Randy Moss at 32 have scored in more buildings. Number 29, the number of regular season wins and losses Miami coach Mike McDaniel has after the Finns were blown out in a windy Cleveland on Sunday, and it sure feels like those figures could remain permanent at any point. 30. Sure doesn't help when your quarterback, Tua Tagovailoa, in this case, throws 3 interceptions in successive games while bemoaning team chemistry and focus in between. 31. The Indianapolis Colts became the first team to 6 wins this season, maintaining their position atop the AFC with a dominant victory in LA. Of course, the Colts should beat the Savannah Bananas convincingly. 32A. From a fashion perspective, the Bolts are almost always on point, but this was no easy way to honor the Air Corbell teams, who never sported such abominations in the first place. Yes, this weekly column is about 32 things that happen in a given NFL week, but when a team scores 33 points in the fourth quarter, the most ever for a club that was shut out for the first 3 periods, will go the extra mile for the Broncos. And now for a column by Nate Davis. Has there ever been a more underrated, underappreciated NFL quarterback than the Los Angeles Rams' Matthew Stafford? If that strikes you as a fallacious statement, then consider Stafford, one of the league's most prolific passers in history, has been named a Pro Bowler twice in his 17 seasons. And that's an honor collectively determined by fans, players, and coaches. That is damaging evidence right there that he's been grossly taken for granted. Second, he's only received MVP votes one time in his career, and that was 2023, not even the year he led the Los Angeles Rams to victory in Super Bowl 56. Cooper Kupp, whom the Rams released earlier this year, was MVP of that game, incidentally. Third, how many times have you heard future Hall of Famer attached to Stafford's name? Perhaps it happens occasionally, but is he often associated with current and former peers like Aaron Rodgers, Drew Brees, Russell Wilson? Each of them also only has one ring apiece, for what it's worth. Ben Roethlisberger or Phil Rivers? It feels like Stafford has somehow been relegated to the Joe Flacco zone for some reason. Not that that's all that bad. And at a time when Tampa Bay Buccaneers star Baker Mayfield, something of an orphaned former number one draft pick like Stafford for himself for years, is getting all the league MVP love, it's Stafford who's basically gotten none to date. That needs to change right now. In case you missed last Sunday morning's appetizer on the 19th, the league's final contest in the United Kingdom this year, Stafford was surgical on a very wet Wembley Stadium operating table while dissecting the Jacksonville London Jaguars 35-7. After entering the day with 12 touchdown passes and a league-high 1,684 passing yards, Stafford threw for five more scores, an International Series single-game mark, and it included 182 yards. Do I get a sword or something, he cracked after his record-setting performance. Stafford's 2025 passer rating of 109.3 is on track to be the best of his career. His 17 TD passes were the most in the league heading into Monday night's doubleheader and are especially sublime compared with the two picks he's thrown this season. Now 5-2, Stafford's Rams end Week 7 with a share of first place in the NFC West, and would have the same record as Mayfield's Bucks if Tampa Bay fails to win at Detroit's Ford Field on Monday night, which we all know now they did fail to do, as Detroit won. Oh, and did we mention that Stafford didn't have injured number one receiver Puka Nacua, whose breakneck receiving numbers have drawn far more attention this season than the passer who is providing them? Nacua sat out last Sunday with an ankle injury. Did we mention that Stafford distributed his 21 completions to 10 different receivers? Two of his TD strikes went to rookies in Nacua's absence. Did we mention that Stafford carved up a Jags defense that was allowing just 20 points per game entering Sunday, tied for seventh fewest in the league, but surrendered more than that, 21, to LA before halftime? Did we mention that Stafford, 37, and the rest of his teammates, who'd practiced all week in Baltimore, managed this blowout despite setting foot on European soil basically 24 hours before kickoff, the shortest amount of time a team had ever been in the country prior to playing a game in London? I believe that Baker Mayfield is the MVP frontrunner, but I also believe that Matthew Stafford is sending the bat signal out to the rest of the league, said former Pro Bowl defensive lineman and current NFL Network analyst Gerald McCoy on the 19th. Matthew Stafford has climbed up the ranks. Matthew Stafford is lighting the league up right now. And it's not like all of us shouldn't have known better. A year after Tom Brady somehow burnished his reputation by leading the Bucks to a Super Bowl victory while capping his first year in Tampa, Stafford matched him by doing the same thing with the Rams, vanquishing TB12 in the 2021 playoffs en route. If it didn't necessarily rewrite his personal narrative, it did help spark a wave of more high-profile quarterback trades, Rodgers, Wilson, Deshaun Watson, that didn't approach the bar set by Brady and Stafford, The Rams reached the postseason in three of Stafford's 4 years in L.A. They were the only team that threatened the juggernaut Philadelphia Eagles, who otherwise steamrolled their 2024 playoff opponents on the way to winning the Super Bowl. That's number 59. Stafford, superb on a snowy day at Lincoln Financial Field in January. And while he and his teammates were coping with the disastrous L.A. wildfires in their personal lives, Stafford's value should have been readily apparent over the summer, given all of the hand-wringing over the back injury that cost him a good portion of training camp, and should have been a reminder that he's as indispensable to his team as is Patrick Mahomes, Josh Allen, or Lamar Jackson. And if you're inclined to hold Stafford's largely fruitless 12 years with the Lions against him, maybe you shouldn't be. He never played for Dan Campbell, though he did elevate the Rams in a manner his predecessor and replacement in Detroit, Jared Goff, couldn't quite manage to do. And the fact that Stafford led the pre-Campbell Lions to three postseason appearances should actually be another bullet point on his Canton resume. Detroit appeared to be a team on the rise early in his career when he played with Hall of Famer Calvin Johnson and Ndamukong Suh, but Suh left shortly after the 2014 season, and Johnson retired a year later. And remind me who was helping Stafford during his final 5 years in Motown? Yet ask Megatron or Nate Burleson or Golden Tate, among Stafford's numerous wideouts in Detroit, and they'll all tell you he's been elite for the duration of his career. He just didn't get the credit while excised with the then perpetually undermanned Lions. Now here we are, 229 games into Stafford's career. He's still low-key elite, even if he's not talked about with Mahomes, Jackson, or Allen. His beard may be gray, but Stafford's whip of a right arm still has as much zip as ever, able to launch seeds from myriad angles. Maybe he's entered his personal Brett Favre era, deciding on a year-to-year basis whether or not he's got another season in him. But he's got more than enough to continue outwitting defenders with no-look passes, rocket balls, or simple game management. What's more valuable than that on a Rams team that has as many wins as anyone in the NFC right now? Good question. All right, let's turn to college football now and read about the best games to watch this weekend. This is an article by Eddie Tamanis, also with USA Today. UCLA, 3-4 overall and 3-1 in the Big Ten, is playing at number 2 Indiana, which is undefeated. That's Saturday on Fox. The spread has Indiana by 24.5. The Hoosiers look to keep rolling toward a return to the playoff. Next up to try and slow them down are the suddenly dangerous Bruins, riding a 3-game winning streak under interim coach Tim Skipper. Indiana quarterback Fernando Mendoza is front and center in the Heisman conversations, making excellent use of wide receivers Elijah Surratt and Omar Cooper, with plenty of ground support from running backs Roman Hemby and Kalon Black. Slowing them down will be a tall order, but Bruins linebackers John Bollins and Isaiah Chisholm will do their best. The UCLA offense has come alive as quarterback Nico Yamaleava has seemingly been unlocked. He must watch out for Hoosiers cornerback D'Angelo Pons when choosing his targets, and he'll likely receive extra attention from linebacker Aiden Fisher when he leaves the pocket. Our prediction? It was a good run for the Bruins, starting with a takedown of Penn State that altered the entire narrative of the Big Ten season. But it ends here in Bloomington as the Hoosiers maintain their laser focus on even loftier goals. Indiana by 49-21. Next game, number 8 Mississippi at 6-1 overall and 3-1 in the SEC, is playing at Oklahoma, who's number 11, and they're 6-1 and 2-1 in the SEC. The BetMGM spread has Oklahoma favored by 4.5. The first half of Ole Miss's pivotal 2-game road swing began well enough, but ended with a fourth quarter power outage at Georgia. The Rebels now go for a rebound in Norman, where the Sooners' defense figures to offer a lot more resistance. Ole Miss quarterback Trinidad Chambliss could use a fast start to erase the memory of last week's rough finish between the hedges. But he and running back Kawan Lacey will be opposed by OU's formidable defensive line featuring Jaden Jackson and Taylor Wine. The Sooners' offense hasn't been nearly as effective, with quarterback John Mateer still trying to regain his passing touch following hand surgery. Getting stops was an issue for the Rebels last week, but defensive tackle Xavion Harris will try to get the Sooners off schedule. Prediction? This is one tough game to figure, as it is the sort of big game both programs have found ways to lose in recent years. Overall, the Rebels are harder to shut down for extended periods, so we'll go with the road team in a tight one, Mississippi 20-14. Next, we have number 20, South Florida, who's 6-1 and 3-0 in the AAC, playing at Memphis, who's 6-1 and 2-1 in the AAC. The spread is set at South Florida by 3.5 points. This is still a key showdown in the hotly contested American, though it is no longer a top 25 pairing thanks to the Tigers' damaging loss at Alabama-Birmingham last week. Memphis could still make it back to defend its conference title, but a loss to the Red Hot Bulls would likely end those aspirations. The availability of Memphis quarterback Brendan Lewis, who left the UAB game with a lower leg injury, will likely not be known until kickoff, so it might be up to freshman A.J. Hill to run the offense. Bulls linebacker Mac Harris will make life difficult regardless of who takes the snaps for the Tigers. USF quarterback Bynum Brown has been putting up huge point totals since being stymied by Miami, back in week three. Memphis linebackers Sam Broomfield and Drew Watts will try to keep him contained. My prediction? Losing their quarterback obviously didn't help, but the Tigers were clearly caught peeking ahead last week. The Bulls have shown no such lapses and should be ready to pass this road test. South Florida by 38-20. Next, we have number 14 Missouri, 6-1 and 2-1 in the SEC, playing at Vanderbilt, which is number 12, also at 6-1, also at 2-1 in the SEC. The spread by BetMGM has Vanderbilt by 2.5. This is the day's second matchup of teams looking to pick up a quality win and, perhaps of equal importance, avoid a second SEC loss. The Commodores might have more confidence coming in after their lockdown of LSU, while Mizzou's escape at Auburn was considerably more dicey. Vanderbilt quarterback Diego Pavia is a one-man wrecking crew at times, though it helps when running back Cedric Alexander and tight end Eli Stowers get their share of touches. Linebacker Josiah Trotter, the defensive centerpiece for Mizzou, will have Pavia under constant surveillance. Tigers quarterback Bo Pribula is also not afraid to tuck and run, though it is running back Ahmad Hardy that poses the primary threat on the ground. Linebackers Brian Longwell and Langston Patterson will spearhead the rush defense for the Commodores. Prediction? These are uncharted waters in Nashville, where the Commodores haven't enjoyed this much gridiron success in a very long time. They're having way too much fun in Music City to let the song end now. Vanderbilt, 31-17. Next, we have number 10, BYU, who's 7-0 and 4-0 in the Big 12, playing at Iowa State. That's 5-2 and 2-2 in the Big 12. The spread has Iowa State by 2.5, the home team. The Cougars don't have long to celebrate their Holy War victory against arch-rival Utah. The Cyclones, who finally got a needed week off, now look to regroup and snap a two-game skid. BYU quarterback Bear Bachmeyer will look for an encore following his virtuoso performance against the Utes. He and running back L.J. Martin will become well acquainted with Cyclones linebacker Caleb Brown. Iowa State quarterback Rocco Becht had a rough outing at Colorado in his most recent action 2 weeks ago. He might be rejoined in the backfield by running back Carson Hansen if that guy clears concussion protocol, but it might be tough sledding against linebacker Jack Kelly in the BYU front seven regardless. Prediction? Iowa State's open date came at the ideal time after a long first half that included an overseas jaunt. The Cyclones will get back on course and hand the Cougars their first setback of the year. Iowa State 24-20. Now we have number 3 Texas A&M, who's 7-0 and 4-0, playing at number 19 LSU, who is 5-2 and 2-2 in the conference. The spread has Texas A&M by 2.5. The Aggies, the last unbeaten squad in the SEC, put their perfect record on the line in Baton Rouge, where the Tigers are in dire need of a win to keep their fading playoff hopes alive. A&M quarterback Marcel Reed has made excellent use of wide receivers KC Concepcion and Mauro Craver when a chunk play is needed. Safety A.J. Halsey and the Tigers' secondary unit must limit those opportunities. One positive development from LSU's loss at Vanderbilt was quarterback Garrett Nussmeier gaining some traction in the passing game. He can expect heat from Aggies defensive end Cassius Howell. My prediction, A&M fans have seen this movie before. A promising season derailed by an untimely subpar performance. Can this year's version overcome its past? We think it will, at least for this week against the beleaguered Bayou Bengals. Texas A&M 27-17. And finally, Houston at 6-1, 3-1 in the Big 12 at number 25, Arizona State, who's 5-2 and 3-1 in the Big 12. The spread has Arizona State by 7.5 points. The Sun Devils are back in the Big 12 mix after handing Texas Tech its first defeat. Next to visit Tempe are the Cougars, who were throttled by those Red Raiders 3 weeks ago but have bounced back with 2 conference wins. Having quarterback Sam Leavitt back in the lineup made a huge difference for the Sun Devils as he and wide receiver Jordan Tyson hooked up often. Houston will count on safety Kentrell Webb, that is Webb, to limit their long connections. Cougars quarterback Quentin Weigman is coming off a stellar outing of his own against Arizona. His primary weapon is wide receiver Amari Thomas, who must avoid being flattened, or rather haunted, by ASU's safety tandem of Miles Ghost Rouser and Adrian Boogie Wilson. My prediction, kudos to Houston for achieving bowl eligibility. But the Cougars were overmatched in their previous encounter with the Big 12's upper tier, and that will likely be the case again. Arizona, 38-16. The NBA started its season this week, so let's take a quick look at the NBA team projections by Lorenzo Reyes, who's one of the USA Today's columnists. The start of the season of the NBA is underway. Coaches and players have worked their way back to game shape, and contenders have their eyes on a trip to the NBA Finals. The Oklahoma City Thunder are the reigning NBA champions and were dominant last season from the start of play to the end. The Thunder led the league with 68 victories, which was 16 more than the Western Conference's second best team, the Rockets from Houston, who won only 52, and 4 more than the leader in the Eastern Conference, the Cleveland Cavaliers. Yet, the NBA has not seen a repeat champ since the Golden State Warriors did it with consecutive titles in 2017 and 2018. Record projections for every team for the 25-26 season with previews of each, projected conference seed in parentheses for applicable teams, they come next. In the Eastern Conference's Atlantic Division, number 1, New York Knicks, projected at 59-23. New York coach Mike Brown should rely on New York's depth far more than his predecessor did. The biggest improvement the Knicks should see this season is a more diversified offense and one that features star Jalen Brunson off the ball more often. Number 6 in this ranking is the Philadelphia 76ers, who are predicted at 43-39. This is all going to come down to the health of Philly's players, the most important being Joel Embiid. He reported training camp slimmed down and has been limited during the preseason, and his comments at Media Day signaled that he'll likely be on a load management schedule. The Sixers, though, could be a candidate to outperform if they can get him consistently on the floor. At number 7, I've got Boston Celtics with only a .500 record, 41-41. This is one of the toughest teams to project. The Celtics traded Kristaps Porzingis and Drew Holiday and will be without star Jason Tatum for at least most of the regular season. Role players like forward Sam Hauser and center Nemias Keita will need to step up. And I have the Raptors set at number 9 with a 40-42 record. Brandon Ingram should boost this offense, and he should pair well with 24-year-old star Scottie Barnes. The key will be consistent health. After missing out on the play-in window last season, the Raptors could rise to a fringe playoff squad. Then they have the Brooklyn Nets with no ranking, at finishing at 16-66. A team that is very clearly amassing draft capital and will be building for the future, the Nets will have to rely on young, unproven players. There will be growing pains along the way, and it's not clear if Cam Thomas and Michael Porter Jr. can carry the offense. Now to the Central Division, where I've got the Cavaliers ranked at number 2 in this Eastern Conference. And I have them predicted at 58-24. One season after leading the East in victories with 64, the Cavs should once again be a potent threat. Losing valuable six-man Ty Jerome will be a blow, but Cleveland retained its core, and Lonzo Ball and Larry Nance Jr. should provide some steady depth. Then we have the Pistons at number 3 in this conference, finishing at 53-29. They broke out last season in a big way, winning 30 more games than the prior year, and the return of guard Jaden Ivey, who came back from a broken leg, should be a massive boost. Ivy's injury forced Cade Cunningham to be on the ball more, and he responded excellently, earning his first All-Star nod and averaging 26.1 points and 9.1 assists per game, both career highs. Another step up should be upcoming. I've got the Pacers at 10th in this division, conference rather, but finishing at 39-43. If there's one team equipped to handle the loss of its star point guard, it's the Pacers, who spread the ball and ride the hot hand. This presents massive opportunities for guards Benedict Mathurin and Andrew Nembhard, though Indiana will need to figure out if Isaiah Jackson can be a viable replacement for Miles Turner. Then the Milwaukee Bucks, unranked, finishing at 37-45. Things are going to be different for the Bucks, who will rely even more on Antetokounmpo to carry the team. Plucking center Miles Turner away from the Pacers was huge, but where else will their offense come from? Chicago Bulls finishing at 35-47. Having made 3 consecutive playoff appearances in the play-in tournament, the Bulls didn't do much to alter their roster and seem to be happy with its current construction. If Josh Giddey continues to level up, however, Chicago could surprise. Now the Southeast Division, where I've got Orlando Magic ranking number 4 in the conference at 52-30. If Paolo Banchero and Franz Wagner each don't suffer torn oblique injuries early last season, it may have been a different year for the Magic. But by adding Desmond Bane, the Magic finally have a reliable perimeter shooter who diversifies the offense. Then we have the Atlanta Hawks, ranking 5th in the conference at a 44-38 record. They revitalized their roster with the additions of Kristaps Porzingis, Nickeil Alexander-Walker, and Luke Kennard. But the biggest boosts may come from the return of Jalen Johnson, who's coming back from a torn labrum, and the continued progression of last year's number 1 overall pick, Zarchapel Rosachis. Next, we have Miami Heat. I've labeled them at number 8 in the conference, but only at 40-42. Losing Tyler Hero, I believe he says hero, for the start of the season is a setback for an offense that struggled in its scoring, especially in late games. Norman Powell is a steady veteran presence who will help, but early reports out of training camp are that Miami will look to push tempo. That would be a welcome lift for the offense. Then I have the Washington Wizards finishing at 23-59. Though they are likely still a few seasons from competing for playoff spots, the Wizards have been quietly stockpiling some talented players. Alex Sarr, Bilal Coulibaly and Bob Carrington have flashed some promise, while rookie guard Trey Johnson could be an eventual star. Then last in this division, I have Charlotte Hornets, finishing at 21-61. The Hornets added plenty of shooting over the season, but their fate will come down to Brandon Miller and LaMelo Ball, and whether both can play with more efficiency, especially Ball. Now turning to the Western Conference and its Northwest Division. Number one ranked is Oklahoma City, who I'm expecting to finish at 62-20. They have their young core locked in place, though Jalen Williams continues to recover from off-season wrist surgery. Oklahoma City is more than capable of winning in the short term without him. But can they avoid getting complacent after winning a title? Then I have the Nuggets from Denver at number three in the conference, finishing 54-28. Trading for Cameron Johnson should unlock versatility and playmaking in this offense, and he should fit seamlessly with three-time MVP Nikola Jokic, one of the best passers in the game. 2 seasons removed from winning it all, the Nuggets are once again very much a title contender. Then I have Minnesota Timberwolves at number six, finishing 45-37. After consecutive trips to the Western Conference Final, it's fair to wonder if this team has peaked, particularly because it lost a key defensive asset in Nickeil Alexander Walker. Then I have the Portland Trail Blazers finishing at 37-45. They improved late last season, and adding Jrue Holiday gave the Blazers solid veteran leadership. Shedon Sharpe could be on the verge of a breakout campaign, but Portland needs much more from Scoot Henderson, who will start the season sidelined with a hamstring injury. Then I have the Utah Jazz at only 17-65. Based on early preseason action, rookie Ace Bailey looks like he could be an eventual star. The Jazz, however, might sell off their best remaining asset for a forward Lauri Markkanen before the trading deadline. It looks like I'm running out of time, so I'm going to have to just summarize the top teams of the Pacific Division. I have number four Los Angeles Clippers finishing 51-31. The investigation into Kawhi Leonard and owner Steve Ballmer's role in allegedly circumventing the salary cap will hang over the franchise until there is a resolution. But this is probably the last season for this veteran roster to compete for a championship. Adding John Collins and Brook Lopez shores up the front court. But at number two in the conference in the Southwest Division, we have the Houston Rockets, who will finish 55-27. Losing point guard Fred VanVleet to a torn anterior cruciate ligament is a blow, but Houston remains a legitimate title threat with Kevin Durant in the fold. They're hyper-athletic and long at the wing, built to defend a team like the defending champion Thunder. Then we have San Antonio, also in the Southwest Division, with a number five ranking, finishing at 50-32. Early indications are that the Spurs got another stellar guard and rookie Dylan Harper, who has shined in the preseason. Victor Wembanyama appears to have bulked up and refined his game, and a massive leap could be coming for the 21-year-old. De'Aaron Fox and reigning Rookie of the Year Stephon Castle make this team a candidate to break out. And that's going to have to finish up my reading for this week, folks. Once again, this is Kent Batty, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. And I want to thank you for listening.